You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Nearly every family has a secret or two, and their revelation can be by turn trivial, mildly embarrassing, or potentially devastating to a family and their relationships. My guest today explores the effects of keeping secrets, how they damage our sense of self-worth, and how they can damage and destroy our relationships. In fact, the old adage of the lie is worse than the mistake comes to mind. My guest today is Jane Isay. She's the author of two previous books, Walking on Eggshells, about parents and their adult children, and Mom Still Likes You Better, about adult siblings. Her latest book is titled Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. Isay knows this subject very well. As she writes, she was a secret finder and a secret keeper for years. After 15 years of marriage, her husband admitted he was gay, but together they decided to keep it a secret for the sake of their two sons. Through her own life and through the stories of others, she demonstrates the pain of secrecy and how the truth, while sometimes ending a relationship, more often saves them. All families have secrets, and the exposure of big ones, parentage, suicide, abuse, affairs, hidden siblings, and relatives are painful, but not permanently ruinous. The name of the book is Secrets and Lies. It's published by Doubleday, and Jane Isay is my guest today. Jane Isay, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your first two books were on relationships between adult children and parents and adult siblings. Now, this book gets to the heart of one of the biggest reasons those relationships are frayed, change, or destroyed in some cases, and that is a family secret revealed. Of course, this is a subject you know very well. You tell your own. What persuaded you to write about secrets and their effects?
Well, my own story, I was both a secret finder and a secret keeper, and I lived with the results of the secret that had been kept and the secrets that I kept about my first husband's homosexuality, and I lived it for 30 years, and I thought, and I had experienced all of, so many of the emotions that I found when I went out and interviewed people, and I thought, we need to face this. We need to understand the price you pay when you keep a secret on your own being and the tragic feelings you have when you learn a secret and then what we can do to resolve this painful moment. And so I went out and I interviewed people all over the country. This was the hardest book for me to write because this is a subject that really gets, as you said, to the core of relationships.
In your own story, you mentioned that your husband revealed to you after several years of marriage that he was
15.
He was homosexual. And what was more interesting, he wanted to keep the marriage together. I assume this was in a day and age when that was necessary?
It was necessary. He was a psychoanalyst. Freudian psychoanalysts were at the time about as homophobic as cowboys. You know, really, Brokeback Mountain, I understood everything they were going through. And we loved each other, and he wanted the family, and he was prepared to stay in the marriage. He had found the love of his life, whom he saw with my approval a couple of nights a weekend and some weekends. And this was we made an agreement. We made a pact that we would continue the family. He could continue his work, and I could continue mine.
And of course, yours was in book publishing, and you were actually working in the same circles, the psychological. Yeah, you were self-help books.
I edited his first book before I found him his editor, and it was on homosexuality.
Well, after the initial shock, can you talk about how being a secret keeper changed your life?
Well, you know, what happens is you close doors. I had developed an excellent surface. I gave everybody the impression, including my kids, that things were just fine. But within myself, the pain, the sadness, and the loneliness grew. For me, you know, when you go into an airport and there's a bathroom and there are maybe 20 booths down the line?
Mm-hmm.
For me, every person that I was friends with, I had to close the door on because I couldn't tell them what I was living through. And so I got more sad and more isolated. And I think you don't like yourself when you're keeping a secret. We kept the secret because we thought our sons would be harmed. This was in the 70s. Our sons it would be a problem for them, and we didn't tell them until they were grown. And my oldest son was very angry at not having been told the whole story.
The younger one was more nonplussed, I suppose.
He was more, I think he was not as tied. Second children are a lot freer and less tied to parents. And he was more relaxed about it. And he wanted to keep his father. And so did my older son. Everybody wanted to stay in a relationship because we loved each other, even though this was a really hard thing.
And what you sort of detail is this slow deterioration from loneliness.
Yeah.
At first, you have your children, and you sort of throw your life into your children.
That's right.
Because the relationship is... And I have to admit, you write that he was fun to be around, even though that relationship had changed.
Yes. I would, and this is the most interesting thing I've learned since I wrote the book, which is when you are betrayed, anger, rage... All of those first emotions are excellent. They cauterize your pain. They give you a sense of righteousness. But over time, the real question is, what do you do with the love? Because you can't be betrayed by a secret keeper if you don't love them.
Hmm.
Otherwise, it's just a bit of news.
And eventually, after your children came of age, and
yeah.
I think what was interesting is you said your friends would see you and they noticed a slow sort of sadness,
yeah.
increasing
yeah.
sadness about
and,
you.
And distance, because I couldn't have real conversations. But once you keep a secret, there are subjects that are off limits, because if you go down that road, you might slip and tell the truth.
Mm.
So every time there's a road that you, a path you might take, you can't, and that isolates you. And it's true of all secret keepers, you know.
And that guardedness has to show up in your friendly relationships. It's
That's
like
right.
they really and, feel like they don't know you.
Well, yes. And after it all came out, people said, you look different. I was more relaxed. And when we decided to get divorced, my first husband was really anxious about his health. He went to the doctor, and the doctor said, what's happened? Your blood pressure is down. Your pulse is better. It, keeping the secret had an actual biological effect on him.
That makes absolute sense, actually.
Yeah, which is why I think... There are many circumstances in which, if you're tempted to tell the truth, you can figure out a way to do it and even survive.
Well, it's interesting. He kept this secret well into the 80s, it looks like, from the timeline you write.
Yeah.
And I was struck by that because by that time, social mores had changed, even in his field, I would think, by that point. And yet, I was struck by something he told you. He says, you know, I have the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
I have my lover, and I have this wonderful close friend, which, oh my gosh, that sentence read like salt in the wound.
Well, it wasn't easy, but there were many benefits. And in fact, by the time we got divorced, Dick had said that he would keep the secret. He'd stay in the closet. It got increasingly difficult. And when our younger son went away to college, I couldn't stand the loneliness anymore. So it all came out. And it was much better, but within the psychoanalytic community, he was an outlier, even in the 80s. I got to tell you, this is a very, they're better now, but he actually led a suit with the ACLU to get the American Psychoanalytic Association to admit gay candidates for psychoanalytic training. I mean, it's only a couple of decades ago, but it was like the time when the dinosaurs reigned. It's ridiculous. And now times have changed. You know, if Dick were alive today, if we were in our 20s today, he wouldn't have married me. He would have found the love of his life, and they would have had they might have had children, whatever. The time in which we experienced this was a very, very closed time.
You write about being a secret keeper. In fact, you were
yeah.
a secret keeper, but you were actually a secret finder because...
Yes.
You were struck by the fact that he was so intense in psychoanalysis. In fact, he was going every day for years. And he was trying to be cured of his homosexuality, as psychoanalysts would try to do in those particular days.
That's right. And they believed it. They believed it was about the mother. In the history of psychology, when there was ever a malady that you don't understand, you always blame the mother.
But, that's right.
It's true. But he thought he could be cured. The thing that was wrong with what he did was that he didn't warn me when we were dating that he had these problems. If he had done that, we probably would have married anyway, because I thought, along with him, that you could cure it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the attenuation of our relationship within the secret that was most painful for me, and I don't think it wasn't right.
You talk about the two roles of the secret keeper and the secret finder.
Yes.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about the role of the secret finder? I mean, it's devastating, usually.
This is what happens. You know, when Dick told me that he was homosexual, my whole future disappeared before my eyes. And I got the chills and I went to take a very hot bath because I didn't think I could ever warm up. And everything I had anticipated for the rest of my life went away. That's the response that you have if somebody tells you something that's going to change your life in the future. If somebody tells you a secret about your past, then you have to rewrite your whole life history in your mind. We are people who tell ourselves stories. That's how we narrate. That's the role of consciousness. It's a story creation. So all my future scenarios were gone, and I was devastated. I was sad, I was sorry, and I was scared, because I didn't know how I was going to live under these circumstances. And it took a while for us to figure out what to do. But I got to tell you, there's nothing quite like it for putting the chill in your being, learning a serious secret about that is told to you by someone you love.
Now, you mentioned that sort of narrative all of a sudden self-destructs. But I would think the creation of a new narrative becomes an interesting thing in and of itself, though.
Well, but it doesn't have, yes, you create a new narrative, you create a new future, but you don't know what's going to happen next. You see, once you have a past, you say to yourself, well, it had to be that way because that's how I got here. When I grew up during the Second World War, my parents listened to the radio. They didn't know whether we were going to win or Hitler was going to win.
Right.
So when you discover something like that, you don't know whether you're going to have a decent life or a terrible life. And the uncertainty is devastating. This is true when anybody finds out something that could destroy a marriage, for instance. What am I going to do? What about the children? What about the money? What about me? Who am I? What did I do wrong? Why didn't I notice? And so on and so on. Your identity falls crashing to the ground. And then eventually, over time, you pick it up.
My guest today is Jane Isay. She's the author of several relationship books, and her latest is titled Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. It's published by Doubleday, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, after you relate your story at the beginning of the book, I want to get back to that initial question, which was, I assume that you kept hearing about family secrets in the course of researching your previous books.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I would think that would be a part of it.
That was part of it. It was all, but the biggest family secret that I found that really struck me in the other books was the secret a family keeps that everybody knows, especially the death of a child in the family, death of a sibling. If you have a secret that everybody knows and the parents say, we won't discuss it, that is devastating in a family.
How does it affect the family?
Because there's an elephant in the room and they can't talk about it, or a gorilla. I can't remember which goes where. But if you sit at the dining room table and you can't talk about the sister who died, you're closing all those doors. Brothers and sisters, if they can't talk about a shared experience, it's very hard for them to stay close. And so one of the stories in this book, is about a woman whose mother attacked her sister with a machete. Mm-hmm. And she was having a psychotic break. And when they got to the hospital, the father said to the daughter who was not harmed, we'll never have to talk about this again, will we? And she was a good little girl. She said, sure, Daddy, we won't. Well, the sisters were able to talk about it, but it really changed her relationships with the world, because the most important thing in her life, she couldn't tell anybody about.
Wow.
And then finally she told a friend in boarding school, and her friend was really upset and said, this is horrible. It was the first time this woman had a notion that what had happened was not common.
Wow, that's hard to believe.
Yes, well, but when you keep a secret like that, you know, children grow up in a family, they think their family is normal. And you really don't get a sense of being able to figure out what is common, you know, is universal in your family, and what is special. You can't talk about it. You believe that what goes on in the kitchen, around the kitchen table, is what it ought to be.
Well, the book starts with several adoption stories, and I,
yes.
I would think, you know, this is a very common occurrence these days. In fact, it's becoming less of a common occurrence because now adoption rules have changed so much.
Thank God.
But you know, adoption was at once a very closely held secret a lot of times.
Yes.
And you detail three different stories in which the outcomes were incredibly different. And it had to do, the first was very bad because she always felt like she was treated differently. And
yes, and also her parents would never tell her anything, never reveal anything about the adoption. They wouldn't talk to her, and she felt that as a greater rejection than being different.
Hmm. And it was really interesting because I was reading that part of the story. I was thinking, how do these people ever become adoptees? The parents, because they seemingly treated their adopted daughter, so differently from their natural birth children.
Yes, and also she was different. She had gifts and talents that were completely different from the rest of her family. I found that again and again. If there is a family with one sibling who is 6 feet tall and she's got green eyes, and her sisters are 5 feet tall and they've got brown hair, there may be a secret.
Well, in her case, once she found this out, she confronted them, and they were basically, look, we've done our job here, basically.
Yes.
That was
and
the reaction.
I think they must have been ashamed. I think she was so angry they were afraid of her anger. You know, people don't like having people angry at them, and it got worse and worse and worse, and I think by the time the parents wanted to heal it, she was beyond healing because she was so felt so rejected. Now, the second story, Maria, she reconciles with her father after 30 years, and they're looking at pictures, and he says, Maria, I've always loved you as if you were my daughter. And she had no idea that she was adopted. But in her story, she found her birth. She discovered that her aunt was her mother, which is very common. You know, the sister gets pregnant, and the parents take, the married sister or brother takes the child. And then when she found her birth parents, she realized how lucky she was to have been raised in the family that raised her. And so that was a happy outcome, even though her father would never tell her anything about the adoption. He said, I love you as much as I love my other children. The next morning she said, Dad, did you say something about that? He said, I don't know what you're talking about.
In fact, she found her natural birth father as well. And
yes.
And they welcomed her in, but it was an utterly different life. She had lived a life that was relatively privileged in many ways,
yes,
and open to a lot of new ideas. And she had a brother or stepbrother or
yes,
half-brother.
Yes, she had a half-brother.
Who was illiterate.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of social elements in this. I mean, the way in which you're raised, how your gifts cohere or work in a family, all of this is really, there are so many elements, but the fact is you really need to know, a person really needs to know who their natural parents are or who their first parents are. And in the third story, Annie is 36 years old when her mother says, your father isn't as dead as I told you.
Yes, that's right. She'd been told that her father had died in the war.
Yeah, and when she found him, she discovered who she really was, because she was much more like him than like her mom, even though her mom had done a magnificent job of raising her as a single mother in a time when it wasn't so easy. And she was always grateful to her mother, but she and her dad, they laughed at the same jokes, and her father had a whole set of children, and she got sisters, and it turned out to be a gift.
In fact, her father's family had been around her whole life.
That's another one. That's the divorced family where the mother had said, your father moved away, they're terrible.
Yes.
And the family had actually lived in the community. That's a very sweet but tragic story. And each one of these shows the problems that when you keep secrets, and the effect of it. I'm not saying that everybody should tell everything, but when it's really important, and it would affect the children or would affect your life, there is something to be said for thinking about how to do it and when. And the calculus of that is really important. because you just don't walk into the room and say, hey, by the way, you're adopted.
Right.
You have to think about it. But well, you've been thinking about that secret all as long as you've been keeping it. So then you have to start. Again, it's an imaginary scenario. How would I do it? Where would I do it? Oh, I'm so scared. She'll be so mad. Now, wait a minute. Is there a way in which we can get over the anger? And you think about it, and you think about it, and you make up all the various scenarios so that when you make the revelation, you're prepared for the range of reactions, all of them negative.
Right. Now, in the course of the book, you detail adoptions. You detail unknown relatives showing up at funerals.
Oh, yes.
Affairs, sudden deaths, or deaths which are attributed to one thing, in fact, one way or another.
Oh, the suicide. Well,
yeah,
this is
suicide.
A big thing. It's not uncommon for people to tell their children that their parent had died a natural death, when in fact the parent had committed suicide. And this is a wrenching one. You want to protect your children. I want to protect my children. I don't want them to know about their father or mother. The problem is that kids pick things up in the house. They are all little detectives. In the story that I tell in the book, the boy actually listened through the keyhole to his mother's conversation with her sister after his dad died. And it took him 30 years to find out the story because his mother wouldn't talk about it. He wrote a book about suicide. His mother said, "Why are you writing a book about that?" So, and we have the most amazing capacities of denial. And this is one of the most important things to know, that we are capable of seeing and of not seeing, of sinning and of not sinning, of forgiving and of not forgiving. This is the great wealth and beauty of the human mind and spirit.
There's a little section talking about, the subtitles, The Pernicious Effect of Enforced Silence.
Yeah.
And you say the post 9/11 cliche, if you see something, say something.
Yeah.
And give us a sense of how that works in the dynamic of a family.
Well, if there's a situation in which something has happened and nobody is allowed to talk about it, children tend to blame themselves for what bad has happened. Somebody I interviewed for the sibling book who's not in this book. Her brother died the weekend before he was to start. He was hit by a car the weekend before he was to start first grade. And the family, she knew something was happening, and then her parents said, "We can't talk about Bobby." And what happened was she and her brothers were never close until they grew up, until the brothers married women who knew the story and were not traumatized by it. And all of a sudden they could come back together again. The amazing thing about families is when you have a secret that everybody is forced to keep from each other, the relationships between and among them, they shrivel.
You document how your own relationship with your family and others around you changed through your secret.
Yeah.
Did you find that to be pretty universal? Just the fact that the idea of keeping a secret, or if it hadn't been, like in the case of children, I guess once that secret is found, that rocks their life tremendously.
Yeah, it does. But my last chapter is called Getting to Know You, and that's about the benefits of revealing who you are and what's going on to the people you love. Because the last person in the book, Jackie, says, "I can be the same person with you and with my mother and with my friends. It's such a relief." That's when you can grow as a person, because when you are keeping a secret and holding it in, you can't grow. You got something on your mind all the time.
Is the idea of keeping the idea of the secret being found out much worse than the reality generally?
Sometimes it's not as bad. It's very hard to predict the response of the person that you tell the secret to. But there is another element which is really important. You know, in the great classic theater, the end of the play is the secret is revealed and the curtain comes down. Oedipus discovers that he's been sleeping with his mother. He puts out his eyes. Boom. In life, there's a fourth act. That is the act of talking and of dealing with the anger and of dealing with the repentance and of making a series of decisions whether to terminate the relationship or whether to find a way to keep it going. We could, you know, and I say in the book, if people have survived Hiroshima and the Holocaust, they can survive a spouse's dalliance if they want to.
Well, it seems like it was pretty universal. The relationships that became seriously troubled after the discovery of secret was more about the lies about the secret than the secret itself.
Well, that is the incentive for coming clean earlier. Because over time, it's the lies. It's how could I have believed you? What were you thinking? You know, and then as the person who has been deceived feels a fool for not having noticed. Of course, we're so capable of denial. If you want something to work, you're going to make it work.
Right.
And those lies mount and mount and mount, and they are in many ways as hard to forgive as the actual act of that has been kept secret. So and that's a very important factor. So when something happens that you want to keep from somebody, think about it. And if you've kept it for a week and you say, oh, I've kept it for a week, I can't tell them now, think how bad it would be if you kept it for a year.
Think how bad it would be after 10 years.
You bet. And we're all capable of all of it. I try really hard not to be judgmental, because this is secrets and lies are fundamental to the human existence.
I unfortunately couldn't read the book with such dispassion, and I felt very sorry for some of the people who were finders.
Yeah.
And I at other times I felt like it's hard to put your feet in the shoes of the betrayed, but it seemed like it was overreaction in some cases, and I assume that just the idea of being betrayed, we're not rational about our reaction.
No, we're not, and that again, yes, and some people overreact, and some people behave in ways that are very hard to understand, and that is the fabric of human being, human life, and it, I think what I'm trying to do in Secrets and Lies is lay out the terrain, kind of a map of secrets in families, between relatives, and revelations, and so that people can have a sense of where they stand and how they might act or helping them to understand people who have behaved in ways that hurt them.
The name of the book is Secrets and Lies. Jane Isay, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Writer Jane Isay speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She was also a former longtime book editor and book publisher. Her latest book is titled Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent episodes, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.